Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Cutting the Curd is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? For more information, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on HeritageRadioNetwork.org, bringing you this month's author interview. Today, our guest is Chester Hastings, author of The Cheesemonger Seasons. Hi, Chester.
Well, hi there. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. I'm so excited to be speaking with you all, and we're looking forward to it.
Oh, great, great, great. Now, not only is your book, The Cheesemonger Seasons, beautiful and delicious, it's perfectly described by its own, I guess, is it a subtitle or byline? It's called Recipes for Enjoying Cheeses with Ripe Fruits and Vegetables. Did you come up with that, or...?
I did, yeah. I mean, obviously, it was, you know, a need to clarify. Cheesemonger Seasons is the second book, followed by the Cheesemonger's Kitchen, which was my first attempt to kind of distill, dispel the myths and the intimidation that people feel around cheese, fine cheeses, and cooking with them.
Mm-hmm.
And Cheesemonger Seasons was really a follow-up to that in that the first book. The chapter about fruits and vegetables and was just too hard to whittle down, and I had so many recipes, and it just kept going. And I've always, as a chef and as a cheesemonger and as somebody who's traveled the world, I'm just amazed at the seasonality of cheeses and the availability at certain times of year for just really wonderful cheeses that aren't always at the peak or even available other times of the year, and I think a lot of people don't know that. So I wanted to explore that idea in the second book.
Now, my first question was going to be, how did this particular book idea come about? But it sounds like it just evolved from the first book.
It did, yeah, and I really, I wanted, there's so much to say. Again, as we look at the seasonality of cheeses and we start to look at fruits and vegetables and cooking cheese, I think that idea has certainly caught on in America in the past 10 years, 15 years, across the board. And so that's not a foreign idea.
Right.
But as we look to artisanally made products, especially dairy products, which at the end of the day really are agricultural products,
right,
as you know, because they all start with grass, and they become milk, and it goes from there. There's a seasonality of those, and there's certain times where certain cheeses are just at their best.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
as we look around at what we're going to pair them with or what we're going to cook them with, we often find that the fruits and vegetables in those seasons tend to go really well with them. So
right.
In that sense, Mother Nature's already in the in the job of food pairing.
So by seasons, you're referring to both the cheese seasons and the fruit and vegetable seasons in the book, and how they how they hit each other.
That's right. I personally, living in Southern California, I'm exposed to strawberries in January.
Right.
Whether they actually
lucky
taste
you.
Like anything in January, remains to be seen. But we tend to have things year round. But I use the farmer's market as an almanac in a way to kind of inspire me in terms of what I want to cook. And I encourage people to do that very same thing with cheeses and visiting cheese shops and cheese makers and seeing what's really at its peak and really amazing right then, and designing your menu around that and what you're going to cook will be influenced by what's really at its best, as opposed to the premeditated idea of what you really want to cook and then setting out to find those ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a chef, you work at Jones on 3rd in Los Angeles?
That's our family-owned and operated shop, yeah.
Okay. Were these recipes already, you were already cooking at the store or selling to people or newly creating?
No, these are really focuses I've lived in Italy and lived in England and traveled France, and I'm obsessed with food culture and history, and more than anything, I think I've really looked towards the cultures where the cheeses, the great cheeses of the mm-hmm. world, really are made, and mm-hmm. I start to look at what the farmers are eating and what the locals in that community tend to do with their own cheeses to inspire them. So a lot of these recipes, it's the very type of cooking that we do at Jones on 3rd mm-hmm. In terms of its seasonality, and it's taking very good ingredients and doing very little mm-hmm. to them, which mm-hmm. is a mantra of mine.
And certainly an easier way to entertain. It's a mantra of mine because it's an easier way to entertain. Just, you know.
It's so much easier. Yes, right. Yes. I find people are just amazed when you give a really, really perfectly cooked spaghetti with incredibly good extra virgin olive oil and perfectly cooked garlic, and they think, well, how is this so delicious? And mm-hmm. Because the ego gets out of the way, and you just focus on really great ingredients and doing them really well, and it's all it takes.
Mm-hmm. How does a recipe become yours?
Oh, God. That's a great question. Honestly, I don't really ever take ownership of a recipe. It's mm-hmm. funny. I was mentored by a very wonderful man named Carlo Medioni in San Francisco, who was just incredible. He taught us that we were really more anthropologists than artists mm-hmm. in the kitchen, and we were trying to preserve the cultures of the great cooking of Italy in this particular case. By recreating these dishes and keeping them alive. So. If there's nothing new under the sun, and if there's some flavor combination I may have stumbled upon that seems unique or is new, then I think it's either totally by accident or chances are it does exist somewhere else in the world. So, mm-hmm. And again, I think that goes again back to that idea of taking the ego mm-hmm. out of the food mm-hmm. and just being able to appreciate it for what it is, which mm-hmm. is just delicious.
But are there rules about that in terms of cookbooks, cookbook rules in terms of putting a recipe in that someone will say, I had that first?
No, it's very hard. It's hard to copyright a recipe per se, okay. especially when we're looking at traditional foods.
Right.
I love to give credit where credit's due, and part of my passion about writing cookbooks is obviously telling the stories leading up to the recipes mm-hmm. because I think especially when we're trying to recreate other cuisines of other cultures, the why of a recipe is imminently as important as the how
yes.
of a recipe.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you really want to appreciate all the flavors of a dish, which aren't just what's in your mouth, but what's in your mind and your heart as you're
mm-hmm.
enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much work, and do you have help, how much work do you have in refining the recipes for the public to cook? Like, do you have to dumb them down for us, or are they exactly the way you might prepare it in a restaurant or at home?
Well, I know a lot of, amazing chefs who have Michelin restaurants, and they struggle with that idea of how to take this restaurant cooking and translate it to the home. I'm fortunate enough to be extremely passionate about the rural and traditional cooking of France and Italy and mm-hmm. even England, which ultimately starts in the home, and then it finds its way up to into the kitchens of the restaurants, but ultimately comes back to the home. And mm-hmm. I go back to the grandmas mm-hmm. and the mothers who are cooking so wonderfully in the places that I visited and lived. And I find that it's easily translated. But again, it really comes down to taking those great ingredients and doing very little to them. And so this is all very humble, simple mm-hmm. farmstead cooking mm-hmm. From a variety of different places.
Mm-hmm. So the recipes are more almost composed than slaved over the stove.
Certainly. I mean, mm-hmm. I have a passion for fresh pastas and flatbreads and making mm-hmm. dough, and I do love that, and I have a pretty deft hand at it, but I do it every day, and I love to cook that way for my family and my mm-hmm. children. That's something I love to do, but mm-hmm. some of the recipes I find people responding to the most are the simple things, like getting really, really wonderful, crisp rainbow radishes into a definitely ripe brie and eating that on its own. And, you know, here there's no cooking involved. It's sort of the idea of putting these two things together.
Right. And you, if you haven't thought of it before, it's an amazing idea. And
it's
delicious.
A revelation. I mean, look at everybody's recently, you know, honey, you find honey on it, you know, it sort of drizzled all over the cheese boards of the big restaurants. And that's the natural combination that's been going on in farmers markets in Europe for centuries. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long from beginning to end do you work on a book like this?
Oh, goodness. You know, some of the recipes or the stories are things that I take note of in my journeys. And other times in the case of Cheesemonger Seasons, it was really a delight to go, to have that mandate and have that that seasonal calendar to look at and say, okay, here's, you know, these are when these vegetables are at their height, and these are when these cheeses are at their height, and how can I go about doing this? But you're actually right, really quickly. I'd say within 6 months, the whole book is pretty much done. And in the case of both books, I did some of the photography as well, which can actually be almost more arduous than the actual writing of the recipe.
And the photos are beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Both of the cheese and the food.
Well, the approach that I'm really no photographer. I think I have a pretty good eye and a really nice camera, which I think goes a long way. But it kind of comes back to that idea of simple as best. You take natural lighting and beautifully, naturally wonderful looking product, and there's not much you can do to mess it up. You know, cheese has a life to it. It has a beauty to it. All of its imperfections are what make it so beautiful and mesmerizing. And the bandage wrapping and the leaves that are used to wrap around some, or the chalky whiteness and the textures of it are mesmerizing.
Right,
so,
and the close-ups.
After that is a big challenge. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you say there's less food styling that goes on in a cheese picture than in a food picture?
For me, it is, yes. And, you know, in the case of the I also worked with Joseph Tadeo, who did a lot of photos in my first book, and we were nominated for the James Beard Award for those, which was really, really an honor for us. It really became, you know, obviously for him to do more of the food styling aspect of it, and for me to just kind of take the raw, natural shots of some of the ingredients and especially the cheeses. You take a big, huge reel of Cantal and you split it in half and you put it up against the right background and in some natural sunlight, and that's it. There's three shots and you know you have that picture because it's just capturing the essence of that raw beauty in all its glory.
Now, what part of writing the book is the hardest part for you? Are there any parts that make you think, I'm never doing this again?
You know, whittling it down is really difficult. I have a bit of an addiction when it comes to books. Anyway, as a bibliophile of not only history but cookbooks, almost to a fault. I buy so many wonderful 300, 400, and 500-page books. Clifford Wright, who did the foreword to Cheesemonger's Kitchen, is famous for his incredible Mediterranean Feast, which comes in somewhere around 700 pages. So, and I think, boy, that's the book. I'm probably destined to write that book because it's almost easier. I can't remember who it was that once said, who wrote a 4-page letter to a friend, and at the end of it, he said, P.S., I'm sorry I couldn't have made this note shorter, but I just didn't have time.
And it takes time to make things short.
It does. It really does. So as I'm obviously illustrating now, you can just go on and on and on.
Right. So you don't like to exclude recipes. You, like, want to include them all.
I do, yeah, and maybe then I do become a little possessive or fatherly in that regard. But I feel like, wait a minute, these are wonderful recipes, and there's just this sort of finite, you know, place to put them.
Do you take time off to write, or do you fit it into your schedule?
These days, I've been writing pretty much more and more. I'm doing a lot of I'm researching two other books right now and developing those recipes. So it's really, you know, it has kind of taken over in a life of its own. It's something that started out as a simple desire. So, you know, I sell cheese when I'm not cooking. You know, in the shop, when we have over 700 and some odd cheeses on a great day. And I love being there and putting cheese in people's hands and shoving it down their throat at times and saying, just taste it. Don't worry about what you think you're supposed to like. Just try this. If you don't like it, that doesn't mean you're less sophisticated. It just means you don't like that cheese. That's fine when you do.
Right.
But cheese is like, it's like fine wine or art. People are made to feel that if they don't know everything about it, then they might as well not know anything. And I really hate that. I don't like that snobbery. I think, you know, cheese is such a, it's a wonderful thing for mm-hmm. people to discover what they like. And the more I have that interaction with people, the more I realize, boy, one of the great ways to just sort of get over that is to, you know, bring that cheese into the kitchen and cook with it the way those back in Europe are so used to doing. So that's how it started. And now, as I said, it's just become, you pull one thread and suddenly the whole thing starts unraveling. And, oh, I should do a book about this.
I was going to ask you, that segues into the next question, and I'm wondering still what the answer is. You know, because your books start with the cheesemonger, is that your primary identity? Is it cheesemonger, chef, or writer at this point?
At this point, boy, I guess it's a combination of all of those. I am branching away from the cheesemonger series for a moment to work on a very comprehensive book about Italian flatbread, which I think is, you know, on one hand, we think of pizzas, but there's such a almost a diaspora of different hearth breads throughout Italy that start with focaccia, but then go in some really unbelievably esoteric and bizarre, almost crepe-like creations way up in northern Italy. And I've got something like 250 recipes already, you know, put together for that tome. That'll get whittled down to another 90, I'm sure. But it's a passion of mine. I love dough, and I love baking, and you know, of course, cheese always finds its way in there. But no, I was a chef for many years and lived in all over Italy when I was younger, and just exposed to every element of the kitchen. And so, I unfortunately find a passion in pretty much every aspect. I could do a book on olive oil. I could do a book on charcuterie. I could keep, you know, these incredible ingredients that you're given they're just a blessing, and a little bit goes a long way.
And it sounds like you like the researching part as well.
Oh, I love it. I do. I love the history of it and the, you know, telling stories, because I do get a chance to travel with my family, and we make it a point to visit farms and visit cheesemakers and visit, you know, the agricultural parts of Europe, which I think are infinitely more interesting than the museums, as much as I love fine art.
It's time for us to take a break. We're going to get into those topics after the break. This is Cutting the Curd. This is Diane Stemple talking to Chester Hastings, the author of The Cheesemonger Seasons. We'll be right back. You are listening to Aztec Soldiers by the Spiral Jetty Club.
Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
We're thrilled to announce a special event, the Silver Snail 25 Years of Slow Food. This event is hosted by Slow Food USA, Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's Pizza. It's been 25 years since Carlo Petrini and a group of activists launched a peaceful revolution to defend regional traditions, good food, gastronomic pleasure, and the slow pace of life. The slow food movement has since evolved into a comprehensive approach to food that recognizes strong connections between plate, planet, people, politics, and culture. Today, this movement involves thousands of projects and millions of people in more than 160 countries worldwide. Join us for a dialogue between Slow Food's founder, Carlo Petrini, and locavore activist, Alice Waters, as they reflect on the evolution of the food movement and all things slow. Friday, October 3rd from 11:30 to 2:30. You can go to our website and click on the link on the right-hand side of the page to RSVP. We can't wait to see you there.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Savera Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, it's Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. I'm back with Chester Hastings, who's written The Cheesemonger's Season and The Cheesemonger's Kitchen. Are you back, Chester?
I'm right here, yes.
Oh, good. So I know you referred to traveling in Europe, learning about cheese and food and cooking. Where were your main lessons learned, and how often do you get to go back?
Oh, well, I was very blessed at a young, very early age. I was sent by my mentor as his apprentice to Italy, and I spent a little over 2 years all over Italy. So I started in Venice and worked my way down all the way to Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
It was in Sicily, I think, it all kind of came together for me because I really had an opportunity to do and see things that I just had never dreamed of, including milking sheep at 4 a.m. and then making a ricotta with that fresh sheep's milk, and then eating that hot ricotta with homemade sesame bread with these amazing shepherds that didn't even speak Italian. It was an amazing patois of Arabic and Italian and Greek. And it was just an incredible experience for me, and the flavors of that still linger with me, and it really inspired me to look to the homes I spent some time working. I was blessed to work with Harry in Harry's Bar in Venice, and restaurant to Diana in Bologna. But as much as I learned from those great restaurants and being in those kitchens, it really was being in the homesteads and the farmhouses of these rural locations that really inspired me to cook in a way that I continue to cook to today. I go back pretty much as much as we can. My family loves to travel, obviously, and absorb that. So when my son was 1 year old, we put him on a plane and brought him with us to Piemonte to visit a goat farm way up in the Alps, which was just an incredible experience.
That was his first trip to Europe?
That was his first trip, and since we've gone back to Provence, and we're planning a trip out to the Cotswolds next year as well, because the food scene in England has just exploded in a way.
That's true.
That is really exciting, and not as it was when I was there in the early '90s, living and cooking in London.
Mm-hmm.
It had not reached the fevered pitch it is now.
Well, English cheese has grown in amazing leaps and bounds as well. The artisanal cheese.
It has. Yes, it has. It has. And it's funny, saying all of this about Europe, it really dawned on me a few years back when I went back to my hometown of San Francisco for the first Slow Food Festival that was being done here, where I saw 80,000 people come to San Francisco, and all there to taste American-made artisanal products. And this was everything from the goat cheese in upstate New York to the prosciutto in Iowa and jams made everywhere. It was just amazing because I realized, in a way, I kind of had it wrong. I've always been focused on getting those ingredients from Europe and bringing them back here to recreate those flavors of those cuisines.
And now we have our own.
The Italian way to cook, or even the French way to cook, would be to take what's fresh and local and made right up the road from you as close as possible and use that and try to create something out of that, because that's ultimately the mentality behind it. So while these incredible artisans they're not going to recreate or reproduce Parmigiano Reggiano, there certainly are incredible cheeses that are in their own right as good and developing in their own history here in America. And that really excited me to see all of these American artisanal products taking root.
In your book, you're very good at describing and convincing the reader of the need for some unusual ingredients. Like, one was the pine syrup. What is
the
that? Yeah, that's from Italy?
It's from Italy, and it's just so funny you say that.
Tell me about that one.
Last night, my son's 7-year-old, and he's still trying to convince his friends of, you know, he's trying to get the story down right, because he loves to tell the story almost as much as he likes the syrup. But this is made by an amazing woman. My son calls her a witch, but I think he means that in a wonderful way. And she goes around up in northern Italy, in the Alps, and she picks the pine cone buds while they're still just buds, and she puts them in these big, huge glass jars, and it leaves them there for a few days in the sun, and what little syrup or sap is in them will get released, and then she takes that sap and cooks it down with raw sugar over in these copper cauldrons over these olive wood fires out in the woods, and she cooks that down to this incredible syrup, and it has the flavor of a pine forest, but it's not medicinal in any way.
It's sweet?
It's very sweet. Okay. Yeah, literally a drop of of that on a bowl of vanilla ice cream is all you need.
And is it the consistency of honey or?
Honey. Yeah, somewhere between a really thick maple syrup and a honey.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what color is it?
And it's a beautiful dark, dark amber color dark caramel. I mean, it looks black in the jar, and then you pour it out onto I love it with sharp cheeses, or blue cheeses. There's a wonderful chalky cheese from the area where this is made that I love it with. But it's also delicious on ice cream. I put a little drop on vanilla ice cream with some toasted sesame seeds, and it really is one of the most elegant flavors. I've even heard people make a martini out of it as well. So
these days, they throw anything into drinks.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But again, it's this idea, you know, it's like a really true aceto balsamico, which, you know, these days is not really known by people, because that has become such a distilled, almost bastardized thing in so many ways. But the really, really true aceto balsamico is, I mean, an eyedropper is needed to really dispense the amount one would need. And so what seems as overly expensive or cost prohibitive ingredient, a little bit goes such a long way that in the end, it's really not. If taken care of and put in a dark place, you can have it for months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It lasts.
Yeah.
Where do you get it in Los Angeles?
Well, Jones on Third, we sell a lot of it.
Oh, okay.
You know, more and more online. Even I think online is a great resource these days for people to, you know, who don't
find
have
anything.
A really fine foods or gourmet retail store in their shop. And there's some incredible resources online that even I use when I have a hard time finding something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, these recipes in your book, you make them at home and you make them in the store. Which would you recommend for parties with younger children?
Well, again, food is one of those things. If you don't talk down to people or you don't cook down to people, you'll find it's, you know, these days I have little 6-year-old girls asking at the cheese counter for the stinkiest blue they've got, you know. it is amazing to me the palate of a small child that's just fed, you know, real food from an early age. That's what they'll eat, is real food.
Right.
You know, if you only sort of cater or pander to that little delicate palate of theirs, I think they're missing out on a lot. But having said that, you know, moving forward, there are so many of the recipes, especially the pastas and the peaches and things of that nature, where you can, you know, take fruit that they already like. I mean, one of my kids' favorites is the strawberry risotto, which is a very traditional Venetian recipe. And it's, you know, what kid doesn't like pasta with butter and cheese, which
That's
at the end
true.
Of the day is what the flavor profile of a risotto is. But here it's stained with the sugar-sweet, beautiful strawberries, and it becomes this very romantic pink. And you throw those in just at the end, and so there's that really seductive, warm fruit chunks inside this creamy risotto, but with the Parmigiano cheese and a little bit of cracked pepper, if you like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mesmerizing, and it seems so romantic and mysterious in a way, and yet it's right. So things like that gives love.
That sounds great. Now, what American cheeses have excited you in recent years? I know you're on the West Coast. You have a great many cheesemakers to go visit. Do you visit them?
I do, yes, I love the opportunities at the American Cheese Society events, and even going up to Petaluma, I was there for the Cheese Festival last year as their guest of honor, and so meeting cheesemakers to me is just like meeting rock stars, you know. I get all giddy and weird, and here I live in L.A., I can see famous people all the time and don't think anything of it.
But, right, movie stars, who cares?
Yeah, you can have them. I love a lot of the, I'm always fascinated by the people that have forged it, that have been doing it before anybody thought it was cool to do, or before it was, you know, smart or financially, you know, soluble to do. But I do think, things like Rogue River Blue, which is just one of the most amazing cheeses in the world on its own right. And here's a cheese that obviously took its inspiration from Valdion and some of the great Spanish blues of wrapping raw cow's milk, in wine-soaked grape leaves and inoculating it, letting it do its thing. But it's an amazing cheese, and the people that make it are just as amazing in Southern Oregon there. I think the Tarentaise Reserve, which was a big hit at the most recent American Cheese Society.
The best in show.
It's an incredible cheese, and it really reminds us of those great Alpine French cheeses, like Beaufort and Cantal, that we long for. And as laws get more sort of Orwellian almost when it comes to bringing some of these cheeses in, let alone making them at all anymore, it really, we're forced to look around us and find those flavors that we can get. I think Island Brebis out of Washington is incredible as well. It's a sheep's milk, an aged sheep's milk cheese, and I'm a huge fan of pecorinos, both young and aged, which are, the pecorinos are the aged sheep's milk cheeses of Italy. And that reminds me of the really great pecorinos out of Sardinia. It's just got that wonderful nutty flavor that comes from aging really good quality sheep's milk that I love. I think Windermere from Jasper Hill is incredible. Of course, there's a cheese called Forstercasa, which it reminds me of as well. But it's just...
It's also wrapped with wood.
Go ahead.
It's also wrapped with wood, Forstercasa.
Yes, exactly, yes. And just the mystery and the passion of all of these amazing people here in America that are doing leaps and bounds to further that idea of taking what's good and local and fresh and making it magical for us and creating our own history and our own culture with that. It's just exciting. There's another book in and of itself.
It's an exciting time to be in food, I guess. Well, thank you, Chester, very much for speaking to me about your book and about your cheese thoughts and travels. Everyone should look for his book, The Cheesemonger Seasons. And goodbye from Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. I'll be back in October talking to Lou DiPaolo, author of DiPaolo's Guide to the Essential Foods of Italy. Thanks very much.
Cheese. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.